did Israel violate the laws of war?
Systematic attack against a civilian population in line with the state or organizational policy may also implicate the commission of crimes against humanity.
Plus, China seeks to expand its reach towards Europe.
The port would give China access to a trade route to Europe that bypasses Russia, which is now heavily sanctioned by the West.
And later, an update from Kyiv. Vladimir Putin is in Vietnam. China and the Philippines face off in the South China Sea. And today is World Refugee Day. It's Thursday, June 20th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Global crises. Good evening. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The UN Human Rights Office said Israeli forces may have violated the laws of war in Gaza and failed to distinguish between civilians and fighters. Another UN inquiry on Wednesday said the high civilian cost amounted to extermination of Palestinians in Gaza. Israel has dismissed both reports. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has more.
Israeli forces may have repeatedly violated the laws of war and failed to distinguish between civilians and fighters in the Gaza conflict, according to the UN Human Rights Office on Wednesday. Separately, the head of a UN inquiry accused the Israeli military of carrying out the extermination of Palestinians. The UN Rights Office, or OHCHR, issued a report examining six Israeli attacks that caused many casualties and destroyed civilian infrastructure. This was its spokesperson, Jeremy Lawrence.
It notes that unlawful targeting, when committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack against a civilian population in line with the state or organizational policy, may also implicate the commission of crimes against humanity.
Israel's permanent mission to the United Nations in Geneva characterized the analysis as factually, legally, and methodologically flawed. It said the OHCHR had, at best, a partial factual picture. Lawrence said the attacks examined occurred before December, but were part of a continued pattern, though it was getting harder to assess the situation on the ground as the war went on. In a separate meeting of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, the head of the UN Commission of Inquiry, Navi Pillay, said perpetrators of abuses in the conflict must be brought to account. She repeated findings from a report published last week that both Hamas militants and Israel have committed war crimes. But she said Israel alone was responsible for the most serious abuses under international law, known as crimes against humanity.
We conclude that Israeli authorities are responsible for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and violations of international humanitarian and human rights law, including extermination, intentionally directing attacks against civilians and civilian objects, murder or willful killing, using starvation as a method of war, forcible transfer, gender persecution targeting Palestinian men and boys, sexual and gender-based violence amounting to torture, and cruel or inhuman treatment.
Israel, which does not cooperate with the inquiry and alleges an anti-Israel bias, chose the mother of a hostage held by Hamas to speak on its behalf at the meeting.
The international community must not allow political consideration to override our core human values.
And it criticized the report on the grounds that it did not give due attention to the hostages taken by Hamas in its attack on southern Israel on October 7th.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters reporting for us. Meanwhile, in Europe, the security of the Ukrainian energy sector remains one of the biggest issues for the country, as President Volodymyr Zelensky discusses ways to increase the protection of energy facilities with his allies. All this as Russian forces continue to target Ukrainian infrastructure with missiles and drones. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Before dawn on Thursday, Russian forces launched another combined strike across Ukraine. However, Ukrainian air defenses were able to intercept 5 of the 9 missiles and all 27 drones that Russia launched. As a result of the attack, energy infrastructure facilities were damaged in 4 regions. The main areas of the attack were in the east, in particular the Dnipropetrovsk and Donetsk regions, as well as the Kyiv and Vinnytsia regions. One of the biggest energy companies in Ukraine reported that the Russians attacked their thermal power plant, injuring 3 workers. In the meantime, President Zelensky held a meeting with top officials to discuss the energy situation and noted that solutions are being prepared that will help make the heating season easier.
Ми маємо повернути реальну енергетичну безпеку в усіх її аспектах.
Zelensky emphasized that he is discussing specific actions for protecting energy facilities from Russian strikes with partners. Meanwhile, the International Atomic Energy Agency will support the construction of new power units at the Khmelnytskyi nuclear power plant in the western part of Ukraine, and considers these intentions of Ukraine as provident, said the agency's Director General Rafael Grossi. The construction will begin as soon as the appropriate bill is approved by the Ukrainian parliament. According to the Ministry of Energy of Ukraine, Herman Galushenko, the third block can be connected to the network in 3 years after the start of the construction works, while the fourth one in 4 years. A large number of specialists from the occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, who were forced to evacuate from the station, will take part in the construction of these blocks. Rafael Grossi noted that the International Atomic Energy Agency will support these actions and also said that he discussed this with the Minister of Energy of Ukraine and the Director of Energoatom, which operates the plant. According to Grossi, the International Atomic Energy Agency believes that these are very timely plans and that Ukraine needs to continue moving forward regardless of how events develop at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which is currently occupied by Russia. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
As Russia continues its attacks in Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin is continuing his diplomatic trip in East Asia. Thursday finds him in Vietnam. Kylie Vaughn has more.
Shortly after agreeing to a defense pact with North Korea during his visit to Pyongyang, Putin arrived in Vietnam Thursday for an official visit with President Tô Lâm. The two countries signed several agreements, including bilateral cooperation on oil and gas, nuclear science, and education. Irina Sukerman is a human rights and national security lawyer and a fellow at the Arabian Peninsula Institute. She says one of the potential factors behind the partnerships are other countries' reluctance to work with Russia on weapons trading or energy issues amid the war in Ukraine.
For him, Vietnam is an important client, which he does not want to lose, and if possible, he wants to steer Vietnam away from burgeoning its new relationship with the U.S.
Sukerman also said that while Vietnam is heavily dependent on military aid, as a communist country, they are against working with Western democratic countries such as the United States.
It is concerned that engaging in buying weapons from the U.S. can lead to an unwelcome scenario where the Congress makes these sales dependent on human rights and democratic measurements.
During a joint statement, Putin said strengthening a comprehensive strategic partnership with Vietnam is one of Russia's priorities, while Lam expressed that Vietnam considers Russia one of its most important partners. Kylie Vaughn, VOA News.
Chinese investment in Georgia is set to increase significantly as a deep-sea port is planned on Georgia's Black Sea coast, largely funded by Beijing. But critics say the Georgian government is putting the country's economy and democracy at risk by turning away from Western partners and towards China. Henry Ridgewell has more from Tbilisi.
Anaklia, on Georgia's Black Sea shoreline, is little more than a small coastal resort, but it's set to become a deep-sea megaport, built and run by Chinese firms. Last month, the Georgian government awarded a Chinese-Singaporean consortium a 49% stake in the project, thought to be worth several billion dollars. The announcement was made the day after the government passed a controversial law seen as tilting toward pro-Moscow authoritarianism, which triggered street protests. Giga Bedineishvili is a Georgian financier and dean of the business school at Tbilisi Free University.
The speculation is, and I think it's a well-founded one, is that Georgian government is thinking about possibility of losing the Western investment and compensating it for some money from Russia and China.
The port was set to be built by a joint American-Georgian consortium, but the government cancelled the deal in 2020. The consortium and the government blame each other. The port would give China access to a trade route to Europe that bypasses Russia, which is now heavily sanctioned by the West after its invasion of Ukraine. But critics fear the project could leave Georgia in a so-called debt trap, unable to finance the Chinese loans used to pay for the infrastructure. Former Georgian Defence Minister Tinatin Kidasheli is a chairperson of the Civic Idea organisation, which analyses China's activities in Georgia.
Georgian government owns 51% of it without having any money for it. They are going to lend the money for fulfilling the obligations they have under this 51%. And I'm pretty sure it's not fact yet, but I'm pretty sure that that money is going to come from China as well. And we will end up in a situation like, I don't know, Sri Lanka ended up, or Philippines, or in Malaysia.
China already has a presence in Georgia, including the Hualing Tbilisi Sea Plaza, a vast 420-hectare shopping mall, hotel and housing complex. Chinese companies are also involved in building new highways. In 2023, Georgia signed a strategic partnership agreement with China and is part of Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative. But direct Chinese investment in Georgia is relatively small, at just over $47 million in 2023, a fraction of European and American investments. Again, Tinatin Kidasheli.
Everywhere you go, you have Chinese companies working. In reality, none of that is an investment. It's all Georgian budget money, which is granted to the contractors, whomever wins the bid. And the reality of Georgian bidding story is that every single contract that is over 100 million usually is won by a Chinese company.
Georgia's government says China could become its leading trading partner. Others urge caution. Again, Giga Bedineishvili of the Tbilisi Free University Business School.
China and Russia, they strategize when they do something like that. They want to invest to then have political influence and have a impact on local situation, and therefore we need to be careful on that.
Georgia's government denies it is seeking to turn away from the West. Its prime minister said China's investment in the Anaklia port ensures the project will be implemented at the highest level. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, Tbilisi.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. It's World Refugee Day. We'll learn more about that in a few minutes. Now, we just heard how China is seeking to expand its influence in Georgia through development. China is also seeking to expand its influence and its territorial waters through less diplomatic means in the South China Sea. A spokesperson for the Philippine Navy said that China's Coast Guard personnel acted like a band of barbarians during a Philippine resupply mission to a contested shoal in the South China Sea this week. It led to injuries and damage to vessels. Video released Thursday by the Philippines shows Chinese Coast Guard personnel wielding axes and spears, puncturing Philippine inflatable boats, damaging their instruments, and stealing from them. A Philippine sailor suffered serious injury after what its military described as intentional high-speed ramming by the Chinese Coast Guard, aiming to disrupt the resupply mission for troops stationed at the 2nd Thomas Shoal.
非方的船只不仅夹带建筑材料,
Lin Jian is spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry. He says that it was the Philippines that started the confrontation and that China is within its rights to defend its territory and personnel. However, there is no international authority that recognizes the Second Thomas Shoal as Chinese territory. The United States and the Philippines have a defense agreement obligating the U.S. to help defend the Philippines if it's attacked. And finally today, our look at World Refugee Day. This month, the Norwegian Refugee Council's director said the utter neglect of displaced people has become the new normal. With crises across Africa, in Sudan, Somalia, the Sahel, and the DRC seeing funding far below what nonprofits say is needed. Henry Wilkins reports.
The UN says about 117 million people were forcibly displaced in 2023, making it the 12th straight year that the number has risen. This month, Jan Egeland, the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, or NRC, said the utter neglect of displaced people has become the new normal. The NRC says Burkina Faso has more than 2 million displaced people, making it one of the most neglected displacement crises in the world. Fatimata Pisako, a mother of nine, fled northern Burkina Faso 5 years ago and says support has diminished since then.
In the past, we were registered by the government, but we received no support from them. A few charitable organizations helped us, but their support has diminished significantly, and now they come only occasionally.
One senior humanitarian told VOA that the sheer number of global crises are sapping the political will to solve them.
Well, it's true that funding for humanitarian work has increased over the years. It's also true that the numbers of people in need of humanitarian assistance have grown significantly faster than the sector's ability to reach them.
Situations like Pisako's are especially worrying, says Kieran Donnelly.
So basically, these people are stuck. They're effectively warehoused, which is an awful term to use when talking about people. But that's one area in which we just don't see any real investment in finding solutions.
Will Carter is the Sudan country director for the Norwegian Refugee Council.
Never have I known such a miserly funding environment, which has led to sort of pretty, awful service coverage for people who are starving. And never have I seen such a level of diplomatic and, to an extent, media neglect over some horrendous crises.
Pisako says she understands the funding problems and prays for the conflict to end.
The international community remains concerned about our situation. And while Burkina Faso's conflict continues, I understand it is not easy for them either. I pray for the conflict to end so that I can return to my village.
Like millions of other refugees, all she wants to do is return home. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, is marking World Refugee Day on Thursday in Sudan and South Sudan, where he's been traveling this week, highlighting the situation of millions of people displaced by war. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir spoke to him from New York and has this report.
Sudan's war has triggered one of the largest displacement crises on the planet, according to the United Nations. It broke out in April 2023 between two rival generals and has pushed internal displacement to nearly 10 million people and driven 2 million more to seek safety in neighboring countries. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, met some of the displaced this week in Kosti, in the southern part of Sudan.
They're fleeing horrible violence, very severe violations of human rights, but increasingly they're also fleeing deprivation, and in particular food insecurity and in some cases hunger. So you have a multiplication of factors that are all generated clearly by this insane war that doesn't seem to end.
In South Sudan, the UN Refugee Agency is working to assist them. But humanitarian aid is only a short-term solution. Peace is what is needed, he said. Again, UN Refugee Chief Filippo Grandi.
My appeal is really to everybody who has any influence on the parties in this conflict. push them not towards the battlefield, but to the negotiating table.
Elsewhere in Africa, the effects of the climate crisis are driving displacement, forcing people to move, especially when coupled with conflicts. Again, UN refugee chief Filippo Grandi.
And there, what happens is that climate becomes a cause of conflict. It deprives very poor communities living together of basic resources, water, for example. The communities start fighting, and this generates displacement.
Globally, the numbers of displaced people, refugees, and asylum seekers have been increasing over the last 12 years to a staggering 120 million. Ukraine, Syria, and Afghanistan account for just over half of all forcibly displaced persons. Filippo Grandi.
This tragic progression would just continue if at least some of these conflicts are not resolved and the conditions for people to return, which is still the best solution, are not created. This is the big challenge.
Grandi warns that it will be difficult for an increasingly divided world to meet growing global challenges. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
In Peshawar, Pakistan, former school teacher Zargona Hamidi is teaching other young Afghan refugee women like herself how to make fashion jewelry so they can help support their families. Muska Safi has the story narrated for us today by Bezan Hamdard.
Afghan refugee Zargona Hamidi is giving lessons in the art of making fashion jewelry from her house in the Pakistani city of Peshawar. Hamidi, who married a Pakistani citizen and has four children, says she started the training to help young Afghan refugee women deprived of education and job opportunities.
It's been a month and a half since I started teaching 15 young women. I teach them how to make earrings, bracelets, necklaces, anklets, and other things. In our area, most of the girls are not educated. Therefore, I decided to help them learn something so they would support their families.
Most of Hamidi's students are happy for the opportunity to earn money. Her student Fatima goes by her first name.
We come here from 2 to 5 p.m. and have learned a lot. I want to learn the art further to start making jewelry at home and help my husband.
Hamidi says that Afghan refugees, particularly women, do not have many opportunities to work in Pakistan. 5 years ago, she was a school teacher, but she lost that job as Pakistan imposed restrictions on Afghan refugees. She says that despite being a college graduate, she cannot find a job because she's a refugee with an Afghan citizen card, which grants only limited rights. She says when officials look at her documents and qualifications, they say you have the education, but when she shows her Afghan citizen card, they tell her they can't give her a job.
I am educated and have a BA, but I can't find a job. When they look at my documents and CV, they say, you have the education. But when I show my card, they tell me they can't give me a job.
The United Nations says that around 3.1 million Afghan refugees live in Pakistan, 800,000 of whom hold Afghan citizen cards. In addition to being married to a Pakistani citizen, Hamidi was born in Pakistan but still does not have citizenship. Hamidi says she calls on the Pakistani government to grant nationality to those Afghans who were born in Pakistan or those who married Pakistanis. It will help improve the prospects of their children who need an education.
I call on the Pakistani government to grant nationality to those Afghans who were born here or those who are married to Pakistanis. It will help our children with their future as they have to get an education.
Hamidi hopes one day to return to teaching school children. For Muska Safi in Peshawar, Pakistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.